It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Birds of prey are much more than symbols, like the bald eagle. They're our colleagues as apex predators atop the food web. They're inspiring in their fierceness and their amazing physical abilities with their sharp claws and eyes, and they are among the most exciting birds to see in the wild. On today's show, we're focusing on raptors, the science and natural history of the species here in Alaska, and the work that's done to care for injured raptors. Along the way, we'll also have segments about bird watching, and to wrap it up, a story about introducing children to nature. It's all happening today on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Radio's audio outdoor magazine. Well, for this portion of the show, I have a guest from Juneau who is a top expert on raptors in Alaska. Steve Lewis is the raptor specialist for the Migratory Bird Management Division of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which means that he's responsible for studying and knowing about these birds. And he's joining us now from Juneau. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So I just to start out with, like, what's a raptor? I feel like I know what a raptor is. It's a kind of a scary bird with a sharp beak and talons, but that's sort of about as far as I go. Is it just any bird of prey, or what? How do we define raptor?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a loose term, but it is basically used to define any bird of prey. And for our definition, that includes both sort of things like eagles, hawks, owls, and owls. So eagles, hawks, and falcons, as well as owls. So both diurnal and nocturnal birds of prey.
Okay. And how many of those are found in Alaska? More than quite a few, it seems like.
Yeah, there's actually, I think it's about 23 that breed in Alaska, and then there's several more that have occurred that have not been that are not known to breed. Some of those could be like a Steller sea eagle, which comes over from Asia, you know, in Russia, and they've never been known to breed, but they're sort of a rare but regular visitor. But mostly there's 23 different species that breed in the state.
Hmm. And so these are the top predators, the top of the food web for avians. But of course they're feeding on fish and they're feeding on all kinds of other critters out there, and nobody really feeds on them, if that's right, if I'm correct.
Well, for the most part, yeah. I mean, it depends. They do kind of feed on just about everything out there that there is to feed on, anything from, yeah, fish, but other, you know, to other birds, mammals, and then even down into insects and invertebrates and that sort of thing. But then within the raptor community, there's, you know, larger raptors will prey on smaller raptors. So there's not a lot of them that are safe, let's just say, except for maybe some of the bigger ones.
But like the bald eagle and stuff like that, yeah. So tell me if this is a myth or if this is true. I've heard this story so many times since I was a little child about, you know, the big bald eagle swooping down and grabbing the toy poodle or the, you know, the pet. I mean, is that something that really happens?
Yeah, I think that probably does really happen. I mean, bald eagles are, you know, they're kind of the quintessential predator. And so they'll take, or at least attempt to take, about anything that's in a decent size class. And so they are opportunistic, and if that opportunity would present itself, they definitely could give a try to that. I mean, they can't take something very large because they just can't pick it up, but they could kill it. So it is, that's actually true. The stories of, I don't know, you see these stories of them attacking babies.
Yeah.
And that, I think those are fabricated, but small pets, that can happen. And I'm sure that pets, especially cats, but potentially really small dogs that disappear, you know, it could be because of, eagles, basically, that might do that.
Wow. So do most of the species of raptor have the same kind of hunting technique of that people might have seen bald eagles doing, because they're pretty open about it, of this swooping down from and sort of surprise attack and just sort of grabbing something and taking off with it?
Well, there's several different techniques. So there is one. So I don't know if bald eagles are an easy one to talk about, and they probably use different techniques. So oftentimes you just see them sitting on a perch somewhere, like on a pole or somewhere over near a stream, and it depends on what they're trying to,
right,
what they're catching. But
if they find something dead on the ground, they're not above just eating that, right?
Exactly. No, they definitely eat carrion quite a bit. So there is this sort of where they sort of sit and wait, sit somewhere, and they wait to see, you know, something that looks vulnerable. So they're sort of scanning and looking for things out there that might look like they're having problems, like another, if it's other birds, waterfowl that are having problems flying or something like that. And then they'll go and, you know, basically attempt to capture it. Then they also use this thing, and I see eagles do that a lot here. They basically fly out over, you know, there might be a flock of ducks down on the wetlands or something, and they'll fly over. And I think they're just sort of testing to see if there's any weak links. And if it, you know, when things take off, if they see anything unusual or something that looks weak or is having a problem flying, then they make an attempt. And if they don't see that, they just soar back over to where their perch is. Then other raptors use a more active hunting style, like golden eagles, or they prey on quite a few like smaller mammals, like ground squirrels, and they actually do this thing where they sort of course along contours of hills, and they're more of a mountain raptor, the golden eagles are, and so they course around these hills, and I think it's an attempt to ambush things, so they catch this ground squirrel away from a hole.
Huh, kind of like stalking, huh?
It's more of a stalking, or they're just actually just kind of surprising things. So they're just sort of cruising along the contour, and if something is caught, you know, unaware, they can they'll try to nab it. And so the smaller raptors use some sort of a variety of some of those techniques. And so like goshawks will do that in the forest, and I think they'll sit and wait, and then they'll make these little sort of short distance sort of charges at things when they see something that looks vulnerable, or they see a prey species. And I think then the other thing is, like, I think a lot of falcons are a little bit more they'll sort of sit and wait, and then they kind of make an ambush. Or also the same thing, like, try and get something to, like, falcons are often trying to get things to lift off. Like, they prey on a lot of birds and get to lift off the water, and then they can sort of nail them.
They want to hit them in the air, huh? Yeah. Interesting. So now that you're naming all these birds, I'm thinking, like, what's the difference between them? Like, a hawk and an eagle seem an awful lot the same, for example.
Well, they're just, it's, you know, they're all in the same, they're basically in just a few different families, bird mm-hmm. families, but they're all really closely related. So, they have a lot of, you know, the same, attributes. Like,
so they just have like maybe a different niche in the ecosystem, maybe slightly different, but they have a lot of the same strategies, it sounds like.
Quite a bit. The same strategies, different niches, that's right. And they have some different characteristics. So there's excipiters. We have a couple of those, a sharp-shinned hawk and the northern goshawk. And they're really more evolved for in thicker forests. So they have like really broad wings and a long tail, which is for maneuverability, and because they're flying in them around the trees. And it's not to say in a place like Alaska and actually other places where you don't see them, you know, in open areas, but they're more of a forest bird versus things like golden eagles or like red-tailed hawks are more open country. So they're more soaring birds, big kind of fat wings for soaring, and they do quite a bit of that. So, and that's another way a lot of these birds will hunt, is just on the wing. They're soaring around and they see something below and they kind of drop towards it. And then you have some of the owls, and that, you know, they're evolved, a lot of them, for hunting at night. So they have these big sort of facial discs that kind of reflect sound and into, you know, sort of the ears, so they can kind of triangulate on small mammals or whatever they're preying on. And so they kind of have, they've evolved sort of different traits to work around different parts of this same kind of concept of trying to get food.
Of hunting, yeah.
Yeah.
As I'm thinking about like terrestrial predators, they tend to be, you know, small families and kind of loners and be relatively long-lived and have small broods. And now I'm thinking about raptors. It's kind of the same deal, isn't it? And I guess maybe that's something about how the ecosystem works and the kind of scarcity of food and the skill needed to be a successful raptor. Am I generalizing correctly that the raptors tend to be kind of on their own, small, you know, their families are small, they're fairly rare, and they live pretty long because they need to be pretty good at what they do.
Yeah, in general, that's definitely true, especially, you know, the bigger ones, the eagles, for sure, they don't have a lot of young, and it is really food dependent. You can have a bald eagle that, I think a brood of three would be really a large brood, so that's, you know, three youngs in the nest, and often, even if they lay, they'll lay two eggs, and maybe only one of those will come off the nest, one of those kids, and that's just really is food dependent, and so it depends on the food when they're, you know, when they're preparing to nest and getting ready to, you know, lay eggs and incubate. If it's really good food supply then and good conditions, you know, oftentimes they'll have more eggs. And then if those conditions continue through the summer and it's good hunting and they can get lots of food and there's food available, then they can, you know, they'll pull that brood off. And if they don't, then they're sort of have this regulation where they basically, they hatch asynchronously. So they'll lay eggs and then they may hatch over 1, 2, 3 days or more. And so there's this, you know, sort of competitive imbalance built into it. So if there's plenty of food, everybody gets food. If there's not, those smaller ones, the younger ones, they end up getting less food, and oftentimes they'll end up dying. And that could be just from starvation, or they can get killed by their siblings. So it's sort of this regulation that's built in to try and still that each, you know, I mean, the goal is that every nesting attempt is successful. And, of course, it's not always, and that depends on food, weather, all these other conditions, what happens to the adults. And so that's some of the bigger ones, and they are relatively long-lived. Like eagles are probably in, you know, I think the oldest eagle in Alaska, bald eagle that's been documented, was about 31.
Wow.
And I think the oldest in North America is 32. So that's probably like the outside. I would guess the average is probably somewhere in the low 20s, maybe somewhere in there. And then you get into the smaller birds, like goshawks or some red tails, they probably live, you know, not quite as long. But similar, their broods are kind of similar, though, and they're sort of built in the same way. With, you know, they may start larger and then they end up kind of having brood reduction depending on the food supply. And then you also have things like there's several birds that are kind of nomadic here, and definitely snowy owls and probably short-eared owls as well. So they do this prospecting. So they'll kind of move around, and it looks like in the breeding season, especially females, until they find places where there's good conditions. And they rely a lot on small mammals, lemmings. So they'll, when they find those spots, and let's, for example, this year it may be in Barrow or the area around Barrow, so they go there, and they may have a brood of like 10 or 8, something like that, because there's great conditions. And if it's a lemming high and there's lots of lemmings everywhere, then they'll pull off a lot. And then they may not end up being able to breed or be successful for several years. So it's kind of a different strategy where some are trying to, you know, they try and breed every year if they can, you know, and it may be just one or two, you know, every year if possible, but versus some that might not be able to breed as often, because it's their way, they're sort of basing it on, you know, these ephemeral conditions. But when they do breed, they breed, you know, they bring off a lot.
Interesting.
And often in these big years, it's for things like snowy owls, that may be what really leads to some of these large eruptions that happen, where lots of snowy owls show up down in the lower 48. It may be because there's been really good production, so there's a lot of young that come off and then they head south kind of trying to figure things out.
Wow, that's so interesting. I mean, they have to be, they're really tough animals, right? And that's how they have survived in the north. Steve Lewis is with me. He's a raptor specialist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he's with us from Juneau. Down in southeast Alaska, they have even more of these birds than we have here in south central, although it's not uncommon to see one kind of cruising over your head in any park around Anchorage, at bald eagles, which seem to be the most kind of the most common things we raptors that we run into. I'm Charles Wolforth, the show is Outdoor Explorer. What kind of conservation issues or threats are facing raptors? I mean, there was the big issue about habitat for the northern goshawk, and I assume that climate change is affecting the whole natural world, and it probably is affecting raptors as well. What are the main conservation issues that you're looking at, Steve?
Well, most certainly, a changing climate is a big one, especially with the Arctic warming and how those changes, what those changes might be. And it's really actually unclear as to what, as how that might affect some of these raptors. So there's several raptors that really only occur up in the far north. Snowy owls are one, and jeer falcons are kind of the other one. We also have a thing called a rough-legged hawk, which is another, it's a small mammal specialist, and it may be kind of a nomadic breeder as well, and it breeds up in the, you know, in the tundra and the North Slope areas. And so how that, how like the warming climate, if increasing shrubs and is going to affect them, it's unclear. Another thing, it could be that maybe bringing more competitors. So with jeer falcons there, they end up competing for nesting sites with peregrine falcons. And so with warming climate, that may allow more peregrines to move north, though there are quite a few peregrines up in the far north, but it may allow more competitors to move into that area. And then the other thing that's kind of is still really unclear is if there's a potential to bring like more different types of disease or, you know, parasites that some of these northern birds aren't used to dealing with that then can survive because the climate is warmer, it's not as cold. And so how the climate change is going to affect things is really kind of a big unknown, and for lots of things. And it's not just up in the far north slope. You have, you know, changes in the boreal forest and how that might affect some of those birds that nest there. And, here in Southeast, it's you'll have like warm, you know, more increased storm intensity, and so it's kind of all over the place, and that's kind of a big one. Another thing for raptors that's pretty important is contamination and contaminants in the environment. You know, they can be what's called bioaccumulators, so they, you know, they eat things that eat other things, and that has a way of basically accumulating chemicals that move, you know, up into these birds. They can, and so that can be really quite a big problem. And so we have things like there's quite a bit of mercury deposition. You know, Alaska's a wild place, but, you know, just upwind of us is a, you know, pretty big industrial country of China and Russia, both of them, and with, you know, coal-fired power plants, that sort of thing. And so we have a lot of sort of deposition issues, and then things like mercury and that sort of thing that you might see in the aquatic environment.
A lot of that mercury is coming from the coal too. So I guess get rid of coal-fired power plants and you help climate change and help raptors at the same time.
That's probably very true.
Yeah.
You know, and then things like, you know, there's with some of the increasing things with that also warming climate for us is there's, you know, increased potential for ship traffic and, you know, oil and gas development and things that then, you know, contaminants, the things that could then introduce contaminants into the system. So, like, you know, I know with the Exxon Valdez, that oil spill down in Prince William Sound, that affected, you know, quite a few things, including bald eagles down there and peregrine falcons as well. And it didn't, you know, wipe them out of those areas, but it probably really knocked those populations down. And
it's being at the top of the food web, they anything out there that's nasty, they're going to get some of it. I remember seeing eagles that were feeding in oiled areas, and you knew that they were getting all kinds of contaminants.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. And like I said, they're really opportunistic. So it doesn't, you know, there if there's, you know, something floating along there that looks like it's worth taking a bite out of, they'll do it. And, you know, it's like I said, it's kind of what, it's why I think, like bald eagles for sure are so, you know, prolific here is that they have, there's lots of food resources around, especially with the ocean, you know, what the ocean brings. So they definitely will go try and eat that thing. So that's another big issue for raptors, especially some of the soaring migratory raptors, is lead poisoning. And they're it's actually really kind of a tough thing to measure, but they're getting it from carrion, and mostly from hunter-killed carrion. So people shoot something and they leave the shot meat or a gut pile, and that actually can be quite like filled with little small pieces of lead. So if you have a lead bullet, and that thing, the whole point is it sort of shatters when it hits and to do the most damage. Well, those pieces can go throughout, you know, a big portion of the meat. And a lot of times, you know, especially the shot part, people just leave that. And so then raptors come along, they eat that. And then they pick up, you know, actually like, you know, distinct pieces of lead
Wow.
They absorb that. And the problem is then they may end up dying, but it may not be because the quote unquote lead poisoning, but it could be then they can't, because the lead affects how they fly, they can't hunt as well, or they get hit by a car or these other things. You have this sort of like the ultimate cause of their mortality would be lead poisoning, but well, the ultimate cause might be a car accident or starvation or something else, but the proximate cause is lead poisoning, and it's hard to define or hard to identify. And
yeah, interesting. And, weird situation.
Well, in the states, in Alaska, it may not be, you know, quite as big of an issue because it's, you know, there's a huge state, and even though there's a lot of hunting, there's a lot of these birds are moving south. But down in the lower 48, it is, I think, where a lot of it is. So a lot of the soaring raptors, like golden eagles, will migrate to the lower 48, and then I think they end up picking up that down there. So there's, you know, carrion from hunter kills. And then there's things like, you know, golden eagles prey a lot on ground squirrels. You know, there's quite a bit of hobby shooting of ground squirrels with, you know, just varmint hunting or whatever, and those things are just left lay, and so they're full of, you know, lead pieces too. And
well, before I get too depressed, I want to move on to another topic.
Yeah, that's good. That's why we should use copper bullets.
Yeah, really, steel shot.
One of many reasons, but
yeah. I wanted to just in a little time we have left talk about watching and finding raptors. I mean, it seems like bald eagles are quite common, and you see them a lot of places. And I suppose that's probably because of all kinds of availability of food from different sources. But some of these birds you've been mentioning are just, I didn't even realize they were here. I mean, it seems like they are species that you see very, very rarely. And I suppose that you kind of have to figure out the niche of these particular raptors and then go out and look for them if you want to see them. Is that true?
Yeah, that is exactly true. So, I mean, there's some birds are pretty can be, you know, quite, they handle sort of being around humans pretty well. Bald eagles are definitely one. They can adapt. And, I mean, they're interesting birds. Sometimes if, like, in sort of wilderness setting, bald eagles can be pretty, really quite shy. But when they kind of can adapt into the urban setting or the suburban setting, they're, you know, they're pretty easy to see and they're not that shy. But a lot of raptors are pretty shy and you just won't see them even though they're there. I mean, there's, you know, in Anchorage, there's certainly bald eagles right there, but there's, you know, there's probably red-tailed hawks in some numbers. There's great horned owls. There's probably great gray owls. There's boreal owls. There's goshawks and sharp-shinned hawks, probably, you know, within the, you know, the Anchorage Bowl.
That's amazing.
Certainly. And, you know, they're just, you know, they're, so it is a matter of like, you know, going to like sort of more forested areas where you might see, you could potentially see these things like goshawks, but they're, unless you find a nest, you know, they're hard to see. They're an ambush predator, like I said, so they'll sit there, and so you just walk right by, and they just won't move. You won't see them. And that's certainly true with owls. Like, I think people probably are hiking a lot, and they walk right past owls all the time because they are out in the day, and they just sit there and are quiet and don't move, and they're in this sort of thick vegetation. But
it's really fun when you do find them, though. They're so beautiful. I say it's fun when you do find them.
Yeah, no, they are. They're all, you know, quite, you know, awesome to see. And nice thing with owls, you know, is that you can actually hear them calling at night, and especially now we're getting to this time of year, great horned owls, they'll start calling soon, and, you know, so hooting, and so that's a way you can get outside, you know, on a quiet night and hear them calling. I think that's the way a lot of people end up sort of interacting with raptors. They hear them calling at night.
Yeah, put on your skis, your snowshoes, and go out across the snow and listen for owls. That's a pretty neat thing to do.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Steve. This has been really interesting. I think we could go on a lot longer, but we have some other guests, and I want to talk more about raptors. Steve Lewis has been with us. He's a raptor specialist for the Migratory Bird Management Division at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he joined us from Juneau. Thanks a lot for being on the show, Steve.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, and it was great to be here.
All right. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Our next segment on Outdoor Explorer comes to us from Minnesota Public Radio, where Jay Anderson of WTIP North Shore Community Radio hosts Northwoods Phenology. We'll hear him talking with naturalist Chell Anderson about ravens in love, an interview recorded several years ago at this time of year.
Chell Anderson is a North Shore naturalist. She lives here in Cook County and joins us periodically to talk about phenology or what's going on in the woods right now. Welcome, Chell.
Hi.
Well, Chell, I saw one fly overhead about 2 weeks ago, a raven with a stick in its mouth. It must be courting and nesting time.
Indeed it is. Ravens, too, are getting in the act. Another one of those birds that gets an early start on the mating and nesting season. And gosh, who doesn't love ravens? I mean,
they're an amazing bird.
They really are. And, you know, throughout the course of the year, they are always, I'm always marveling at their various antics, their incredible abilities, though, as flyers is one of the things that's easiest to admire and be amazed by. But it seems like during the courting and mating time is when their exuberance as flyers and their skills as flyers is really being shown off to the max. So it's a great time of year to really be paying close attention to opportunities to watch that, where the pairs will fly wing on wing in tandem, and they're doing barrel rolls, and they're doing flips, and they're flying upside down, and just incredible, incredible acrobatics in the air. Ravens mate for life, presuming they, for as long as they live, I guess. If a pair has, both partners are still on the scene in a given winter, then their territories kind of become a little bit looser. They're not doing as much enforcing of boundaries of territories during the winter, but starting in late winter, they're going to start enforcing the territories around their nests, which often are sites that they use repeatedly. They may have more than one, could be in a big tree, could be on a cliff ledge, multiple sites, and they're going to be doing a lot of pair bonding around those nest sites, bringing sticks, bringing material of different kinds, not just sticks, bones, you know, have been found in raven nests, soft materials even, you know, scraps of wool, all plastic, you know, colorful things.
These are pretty big nests.
Yes, they are, even when they're built from scratch, the initial nest is big, and then if they're used year after year, they become quite massive. As you know, each succeeding year, the adults are adding a little bit of material to the nest. So yeah, they can become quite large, and that's where the pair will be focusing their attention in terms of courtship. And eventually, the eggs will be laid in late winter. And 2 to 4 eggs isn't uncommon, large eggs. And there seems to be quite a bit of variability in terms of how adults act around the nests. Some nests are really in secluded places, and the adults seem very secretive, and it's really kind of amazing to discover them. But others seem to build their nests in really obvious places and are real carefree, you know, around their nests in terms of people observing them. So there's really a wide range, it seems, of approaches to where to nest in terms of people's habitations and how to act around the nest. But if you happen to have one nest in your neighborhood or come upon one and have a chance to observe the birds around their nests, it's really interesting, of course, to watch how they incubate the eggs and then feed their nestlings. And it's very, very interesting and fun.
Do crows act a lot like ravens?
Yeah, although crows are much more social in flocks. You know, they spend a lot more time in flocks. Ravens definitely gather up together and do things together, but not with the same kind of enthusiasm on an ongoing basis as crows do. They gather together when it's useful to be together and for the sake of sharing and taking advantage of other food that ravens have found to scavenge. But generally, they're more likely to spend time just as a pair or as single birds versus crows, which seem to be much happier mingling as groups more often than not.
A lot of native spirituality around ravens, and I can imagine why, but I think that this is one amazing bird that's always fascinated me. I'm glad I live in an area where there are so many of them.
Yes, I know. We're really fortunate to have them close by, and not something that it takes a lot of effort to go and just observe, to be able to enjoy them regularly pretty much wherever we are in the county.
So this time of year, it seems to me that as long as there's snow on the ground and they're doing their mating and this kind of thing, that's when we get to see the air shows. This is the time to look up.
This is really the time to look up and pay attention, because you're more than likely going to see some pretty amazing acrobatics up there.
Yeah, it's amazing to see with those flips and, I don't know. Why do they do that?
I don't know, but I can't help but anthropomorphize about it. They just seem to really enjoy flying, as do other, they're not the only birds that I sometimes interpret that kind of activity that way, but they really just do seem to love to fly. You see them out in the most horrific weather, just playing in the wind and just seemingly enjoying their capacity to use their abilities to carve out space in the air and go places.
Besides being extremely bright.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that goes with intelligence, just that playfulness. They are among the most intelligent.
Chell Anderson, botanist and plant ecologist, thanks for helping us understand ravens in love.
You're welcome.
That was Jay Anderson of Minnesota Public Radio.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we are talking about raptors, eagles, and hawks, and owls, these amazing birds of prey that we see in Alaska that are kind of the top of the food web and soaring above us. And There's various organizations in Alaska that take care of injured birds, but the Alaska Raptor Center down in Sitka is pretty amazing. If you ever get the chance to go there, Sitka's a great community to visit anyway, but you can go visit the Raptor Center and see these spectacular birds in a really large flight training center that the Raptor Center has, where the eagles can learn to fly again, and you know, there'll be an opportunity for the eagles to be kind of doing what they do naturally there. And we have a guest from the Raptor Center. Cara DeShazo is the lead avian care specialist, and she also has some experience, a little bit of experience in falconry, which I want to ask about, sort of as a sport that has always fascinated me, but then also mostly to learn about the Raptor Center and what they do there. Thanks for being with us, Cara.
Yeah, of course. I'm very happy to do this. It's an exciting moment.
Cool. So how many birds will be there at the Raptor Center at any one time? It's a pretty big facility, right?
It is. We do have a pretty big facility. And really, our birds vary on, just all the time. Because, like, right now we have 30 birds in rehab, but if we release them, then we won't have pretty much any birds. So anytime you come to the Raptor Center, it's a different experience.
It's a little bit of luck. So you release them all at once, huh?
Well, we try to release our birds in the spring when the herring spawn down here in Sitka, so that they have the best chances for success in the wild. So we keep them over the winter just to get them all fat and happy, and then we release them in the spring.
So that's coming up very shortly here, isn't it? The herring spawning.
Yeah, and we're getting ready for it. We're evaluating all the eagles, making sure they're back in tip-top shape to go back successfully into the wild. It's a busy time for us right now, actually, because of that.
That must just be a wonderful feeling to see these birds flying again that came to you injured and unable to take care of themselves.
Yes, definitely. There's a couple of cases of birds that we have at the Raptor Center right now that we didn't think would make it. And they're doing great flying in our main flight center, and you know, they're ready to be released in the spring, and it's just cool to see the transformation of the birds that come in, and you don't think they're going to make it, and then they do. It's amazing. It's a great feeling.
Give us a couple of examples of birds that you've been caring for this year that maybe weren't going to make it, we weren't sure they would, and that now you're getting ready to release.
Yeah, of course. So the first bird that comes to mind is a bald eagle. We named him Yakutat because he was from Yakutat. And we try not to name the birds too quickly because we don't want to, if they pass on, we don't want to get attached by name. So we just called him the Yakutat bird because we didn't think he would make it. But, after doing a bunch of hydrotherapy where we'd put him in the water and have his legs kick back and forth, he really started to turn around. He had a really bad head injury from being hit by a car. And we just thought he was out of it for pretty much ever. But like I said, we did probably about 2 hours worth of rehab with him every day for about 2 months. And he turned around, and it was great. And he's going to get released in the spring, I think.
So this was a bird that was hit by a car, and so it basically had bird cognitive problems and couldn't, and you had to do sort of the kind of same therapy you do for a person, human with a head injury?
I'm not really sure on that because I don't know
what you do for a person.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I feel like we did a lot of, he couldn't use his legs very well. And so we did a lot of exercises for him to start strengthening his legs again. We would stretch him every day. We would stretch out his wings. We would stretch out his feet so that he could get that mobility back again.
It's amazing that I know that there's surgery that's done on injured eagles, which is amazing enough. But then to think of you doing essentially physical therapy on eagles and other birds of prey, which are not necessarily the most the easiest animals to deal with, right? I mean, they're not used to being handled, and they're used to being in charge.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad you said physical therapy. That was the word I was searching for. And, but yes, I mean, it's amazing to watch them turn around like that.
But how do you get them to, I mean, I would be afraid of touching one of these birds because they have very sharp talons and beaks, and they're not pet birds by any stretch of the imagination.
Of course, and that's such a good point. I mean, we make sure we take all the precautions. We put on leather jackets, leather gloves. Sometimes we wear goggles because the birds like to peck at us.
Wow.
So we take a lot of precautions, and we actually, every new hire has to go through an eagle restraining safety course before they can successfully go catch up a bird. But yeah, we get birds all the time that we have to use different methods. Sometimes we use blankets to restrain them. Sometimes we use nets, but we try to use the blankets more than the net.
Wow. So are these primarily eagles, or do you get other kinds of raptors as well?
That's a great question. We get all types of raptors, anything from small solid owls to large bald eagles and everything in between, hawks, falcons. We even get a lot of songbirds during baby season because they get pushed out of their nests. So we get in a lot of them. And we also have a swan that we're rehabbing right now. She actually maybe got attacked by an eagle. And so we're rehabbing her for her injuries.
So you, even though you're called the Raptor Center, you're kind of equal opportunity.
Exactly. Yeah. We take every type of bird as long as it's native to Alaska.
Okay. So are most of the, you mentioned a swan that might have been attacked by an eagle, and then also an eagle that was hit by a car. Are most of the injuries that you're dealing with human caused? That you know, where an eagle's gotten shocked or hit or something like that?
Yeah, unfortunately, about 85% of all the injuries we see are something human made. It might not be on purpose, but it could be anything from a power line to a bear trap. We get a lot of birds caught in bear traps. And hit by cars is because eagles are foragers, and so they are opportunistic feeders, and so they'll eat roadkill pretty much. And we get a lot of times eagles being hit because they're so preoccupied with eating that they don't see a car coming, and then they get hit. So that's probably the number one is hit by car.
So in a sense, you're really fixing something that people broke rather than trying to interfere with nature. I mean, because obviously, birds are going to die out there. It's not like we can save all that, you know, all dying animals, but to the extent that raptors are being impacted by human presence, that's something that you're responding to.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's great in a sense, but it's also very eye-opening that there are so many issues out there that interfere with wildlife that, you know, we don't even think about on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that there have been power line electrocutions and that sort of thing as well. So there's many ways in which our presence here makes things harder for these birds. Although I suppose in some ways also easier because there's also fish waste and there's also, you know, situations where the fishing industry will create more food for eagles and stuff like that too. So I guess
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And a huge part of my job is just, you know, teaching people to, you know, live with wildlife and coexist with wildlife. So that's a very rewarding part of my job when I get to talk to the public about what I do.
Yeah, and I know a lot of visitors come to the Raptor Center, and probably it's a more authentic way for them to engage with these amazing animals than they would ever see in a zoo or something, because you're right there working with them.
Right, exactly. I mean, I feel like this is the Alaska Raptor Center. I mean, I moved here from Florida to take this job. So it's a very well-known facility, and it's pretty much the only place you can really get up close to these birds and see an eagle, you know, on somebody's glove for maybe your bucket list. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned that you had done some falconry, which is a sport which has always fascinated me. It's sort of a medieval sport where a trained bird will kind of hunt in concert or sort of in support of a human handler. And but you mentioned it's not a sport that's done very much here in Alaska, perhaps in part because of the kinds of game that you would pursue with falconry are not really that prevalent here.
Exactly. And another, you know, huge factor is our bald eagle population here is huge. And so those are the hawks that you would hunt with are prey to those birds.
Oh.
So I think another reason there's not a lot of falconry here is because of the predator-prey drive.
Right. You don't want to send your falcon out and have him get become dinner,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Because birds are very protective of their territory.
Uh-huh. Of course. So, but this is something you were starting to pick up when you were down in Florida. Is it difficult to learn, or is it how do you go about it? It seems like something that would be really sort of the hardest edge of hunting to get into, because you've got to get this bird and learn how to train it, and it has to, and you have to learn how to work with it.
Exactly. Well, I got into falconry because I actually went to school for animal training in California. And I really, at that training college, I started working with birds of prey, and they really fascinated me. So I did some other things here and there, but I always got drawn back to birds. And when I was in Florida, I got a job doing bird abatement, which is using falconry to scare away pest birds.
Mm.
So like at landfills, at airports, hotels. So we would send our falcons or hawks out, and they would scare away the birds, and it was a lot more eco-friendly than other methods. So I really got into it down in Florida, and I didn't get to capture my own bird, which is a big part of falconry, but I did get to teach my hawks from the very, very start, which was really interesting.
So in falconry, you have to go out and catch a wild bird to do the sport?
Yeah, so in traditional falconry, falconers go out and capture their own hawk or falcon, and then they train them to partnership with the person to hunt together, and then when the hunting season's over, they release the bird. But I actually went a different way, and there were birds that were bred for falconry in human care already. So I went that route, so I've never actually had the experience of catching my own bird, which is kind of the biggest deal of falconry, but I still feel like a valued falconer.
Yeah, wow, that sounds so difficult. And you must have to have some sort of special license to do that, right? You can't just go out and catch wild birds.
Oh, yeah, of course not. There are a lot of steps you have to take before you can catch your own bird. You have to take a 100-question test. You have to build their enclosure in the back of your backyard, pretty much, and then get it inspected by Fish and Wildlife. So there are a lot of things you have to do before you're able to get your bird. It's not just go out and catch your bird kind of thing.
Yeah, and then train it and everything else. Yeah, this sounds like when you're done with your bow hunting and your black powder and every other way of making hunting more complicated, you could try this and take up the rest of your life. Yeah.
Exactly.
So the Raptor Center is such a neat facility. I don't know how many folks from Anchorage get down there to visit, but I mean, Sitka is a great community, and I've gone on and on about Sitka on the show and how many neat things there are to do there. There's also a bear facility, and there's amazing historical sites. Do you guys actually keep in business thanks to the tourism revenue, or what keeps you going?
That's such a good question. Yes, all of our funding, we are nonprofit, and it comes all from tourists, especially in the summer, but we do get a lot of people in the winter as well. So that's pretty much how we get all of our revenue, is by summer tours.
And what is the visitor experience when somebody shows up there?
Well, it's very different depending on what time of year you come. So in the summer, we have guided tours where you get to go around and see the birds and see a bald eagle up close. But then in the winter, it's more relaxed because, you know, it's off season. So somebody would take you around and kind of give you a one-on-one personal tour.
Oh, nice. And you get quite up close to the birds because they're being treated, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
And that flight training center, is that what you call it, or the aviary that you have there? That thing is amazing.
Yes, we call it the flight training center. And it's probably the most beautiful, it's probably the prettiest and most well put together flight training center I've ever seen.
It is incredible. It's huge. And you can actually, as a visitor, you're so close to these birds flying, which all Alaskans probably have seen eagles flying. I mean, they're pretty common. But to see them that close is just extraordinary. I mean, it just is mind boggling how powerful they are in terms of their wings and the amount of lift that they create and everything. And you can hear that. Yeah, it's really neat.
Exactly. And I feel like the visitors really get a good perspective on the rehab process, because some birds we have in there maybe just got out of our critical unit, and then other birds in there might be, you know, almost ready for release. So it's really neat to see the progress of the birds. Even the visitors can point it out.
Yeah, yeah, great. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Kara. It's so interesting, and it sounds like really fun work, too, to work with these animals.
Oh, yes, of course. I wouldn't do anything else with my life. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. All right, Kara DeShazo, she's the lead avian care specialist with Alaska Raptor Center in Sitka, Alaska. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, guys. Come visit me.
All right, we will. All right, stick with us. Outdoor Explorers continuing. Here's one more segment on birds coming to us from Wrangell, where June Leffler of KSTK Radio says you have to be tough to be a wintertime Alaska birder.
Bonnie Demersian has been organizing Wrangell's Christmas bird count for about 15 years. I meet up with her at City Dock to spot the usual crowd of seagulls, crows, and ravens. There's a man in his car feeding the birds.
And I feed them every day.
Do you? Okay. Well, you're their friend.
Are you counting all of them?
I'm going to count them all, yeah. Thank you for bringing them so close.
On this day, bird watchers all over North America count resident fowl, the ones that stay year-round. It's a project of the National Audubon Society. It's been going on for over 100 years. Demersian and about 20 other wildlife explorers are canvassing a 14-mile area in Wrangell. Together, they end up spotting 54 different species and counting almost 4,000 birds.
You know, it's what they call citizen science. Having people who are not experts but are contributing in whatever way they can. You know, and this just helps build up this body of data that can then be used for all kinds of scientific purposes.
Demersian and I walk to the ferry terminal and then Petroglyph Beach, looking for birds feeding just off the shore. She identifies different species visually by the shape of their body and markings. The bird's vocalization tips her off too. And simply knowing the environment will tell a birder what to expect.
I think it said, you know, how do you do it? You do it bird by bird. You know, you just
bird by bird
start acquiring understanding just a little bit at a time. And I think that's one of the reasons why people get so involved in birding is because there's never end to it. You never know it all.
She has her binoculars and a hard copy field guide. She takes out her iPad with a birding app.
The calls, you know, so that's helpful sometimes if you're out someplace you're not sure what you're listening to.
She also has a clipboard with a list of all the birds she can expect to see. It's on weatherproof paper.
Some special paper. It's called Write in the Rain paper, and you can see why we need it.
We meet up with our fellow birders, Tori Hauser and her two boys.
Hi. And at the ferry terminal, what was that big group of seabirds?
That was Barrow's golden eyes.
We were right, see?
Oh, good. Yeah, and they hang out there all winter long, so you can see them.
And what was
over
your
again.
Count on them, about 75 to 100?
I said 90.
Demersian, Hauser, her two boys, and I continue to the baseball field and then the golf course. It's been raining all day, and it's not letting up. The weather is starting to get to me and the boys.
Are you still having fun in all the cold?
Sort of. My feet are freezing.
At the golf course, we see a group of guys, well, you know.
I can't believe it. Huh? There are people golfing.
Oh, that'll work. That'll work. Oh, yeah. That'll work. Merry Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, perfect day for golfing.
Perfect for golfing.
I can't believe it. Day for birding, too.
I knew nothing about birds before today, but I had heard rumors about birders. They are persistent, even relentless in their pursuit. At this point, we're not even seeing that many birds. Birds, like humans, don't like the wind or rain. But then, we go under a canopy of trees, and we hear chirping.
Here, over here. There he is.
Big
pretty little thing.
What does it look like?
Well, it's kind of a grayish buffy all over, but then on the top of it, its head, it has this kind of orangey-yellow stripe.
Okay, we saw four kinglets and another eagle.
We wrap up our day shortly after that.
How was your birding experience today?
It was moist. but it was fun, and we like to go with Bonnie, because we're not bird experts, but she is, and so we could learn a lot.
Demersion tries to convince me that on a warm spring day, bird watching can actually be one of the most enjoyable things to do in town. In Wrangell, I'm June Loeffler.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Our final segment today comes from our ongoing series of Trail Tales, the storytelling event presented by Alaska Trails in downtown Anchorage. We're going to hear Cameron Perez-Verdia, well known as president of the Alaska Humanities Forum, who is also an avid runner and a dad.
Did you know that there are trees that have lived to over 5,000 years old? Think about that for a second. 5,000 years old. Think about what's happened over the last 5,000 years in this world. The changes in human evolution, the wars that have been fought, the technology changes that have happened over that period of time, the generations that have come and gone, and all that time, that tree is sitting there, watching, listening to all of that go on. So, as mentioned, I'm from Utqiagvik, or Barrow, and there's not a lot of trees in Barrow. But I've always been fascinated by trees. I don't know why. So I had the opportunity, after going to college, to move to Japan, to a little place called Nishinomiya, which is between Osaka and Kobe. And I went there to live with a friend and teach English. I taught middle school and also a kindergarten class, which is a whole different story, not speaking Japanese. But my friend and I had a falling out, and I lost my housing. And if you don't know, housing in Japan is really hard to get. So I had to come back to Alaska, back home. And so I came back to Anchorage. And, you know, I was 22 years old, and I was feeling kind of lost. I didn't know where I wanted to be, or who I wanted to be, or what I wanted to be. So one day I decided to go on a walk to a place probably many of you have been, to the Prospect Heights Trailhead. You've been to Prospect Heights? Right. So, you know, I took off on that real flat, straight part of it. And then, you know, you take that left turn up onto the ridge, and you have that beautiful view of Anchorage. And, you know, you turn to the right and you go back down, and there's this little wooden bridge right down there. And I was standing on that bridge thinking about my life, thinking about where I was and where I wanted to be. And, you know, if you walk right across the bridge, and just to the left, there's this tree. And it's sort of by itself. It's this beautiful, beautiful tree. And I saw that tree, and for some reason, it called to me. And so I walked over there, and I put my hands on it. It's not something I normally do, is go around and putting my hands on trees. But I put my hands on this tree, and I felt something. I felt the roots of that tree diving deep into the earth. I felt a connection to all things that had ever been, to all people that had ever been. I felt this amazing connection to the earth and to all things. And I felt this amazing sense of calm and hope and of possibilities. And from that day forward, that wasn't just a tree, that was my tree. And I visited that tree many times over the years. A few years later, after I got divorced from my first wife, didn't see that coming, I went to that tree and I talked to it about, was it my fault? Did I not work hard enough? You know, it was supposed to be for life, right? But that tree made me remember that, you know, I had to trust my instincts. And I could find my own path. And that was going to be okay. Several years later, quite a few years later, I came to that tree with my two little girls, Isabel and Mariela. And I had them put their little hands on that tree and feel that connection. And we talked about our family. We talked about our ancestors. We talked about the fact that we're connected to all things. It was amazing. And that tree reminded me that, you know, I've got to make sure that I stop and cherish every single moment, especially with them. About 5 years ago, I went back to that tree after my sister Kathleen committed suicide. It changed everything. Changed my whole life. And I don't know if I can explain this, but I don't understand how you can have these emotions that are so different, how you can be so angry and so sad at the same time, how you can hate somebody for what they've done to your family because of what they chose to do, but at the same time love them so much and miss them so much. And that tree reminded me that, you know, I needed to feel those feelings really intensely. I needed to feel all of it. But I also needed to remember to let go. So the last time I was at that tree was this summer. And I had just celebrated my 10th anniversary married to my wife. Yay! And we had a great conversation. I talked about the fact that I'm in a really good place. I'm really happy with where I am. And I'm looking forward to the future. It's a really humbling experience to stand in front of a tree that has been there for 100 years, 1,000 years, and to know that it's heard all of these people go by, all of these amazing stories and discussions that are happening as people pass. So, if you're ever at Prospect Heights, and you're walking down that little trail, and you walk across that bridge, look to the left, and look at that tree, my tree, and I'll share it with you. And share a story of your own, and maybe go up and put your hands on it, and feel your own connection. And make sure you say hi for me. Thanks.
That was Cameron Perez-Verdia speaking at Trail Tales, the event that is put on by Alaska Trails in downtown Anchorage on a regular basis. You can find out more about it from their website, which you can find through ours at outdoorexplorer.org. I want to thank Steve Lewis, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's a raptor specialist, for being with us earlier in the show. And also Kara DeShazo, avian care specialist with the Alaska Raptor Center. That's all for today. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Durham. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.